raising black children in the United States can be really scary. And as a black mother, I realized I was parenting from fear. And I wanted to make a commitment to parent for liberation. You are listening to Parenting for Liberation podcast. And I am your host, Trina Green Brown. Each month, I'm joined by other black parents and we discuss our own journeys to push past our fears so that we can raise our beautiful black children to be whole, free, and liberated. Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping. My name is Trina. And I'm the founder and executive director of Parenting for Liberation, and we are here in for a treat.
Yes.
We are here to talk about parenting and grief and loss, and how do we create practices, rituals, to dig into that and not run away from the hardness of it, and find ways for us to collectively heal and also heal ourselves individually. Mm-hmm. And so before we get started, I know Gina was going to create an offering for us to ground as a group, and then we'll integrate into the conversation. This is family. We're recording this, but we are family. So although it may feel like a big to-do, I just want us to honor our relationships in this space and honor the realness of the conversations as they come up. And we'll get into more of that as we progress into the conversation. We'll have space at the end if you all have questions, and then we'll conclude.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Hey, y'all. It's really good to be here. I happen to have a big love for Trina. And so to be in her presence is always a gift for me. To open a space for me is always to join in some shared agreement. Right? Meaning a shared thought, a shared sound, a shared intention, knowing that we all are coming from our lives, which if your life is lifing like my life is lifing
yes.
right now, it's full, you know? But while we're in the room, grounding in shared agreement helps us to just create our own multiverse right here, right now. And to be able to the best of our capacity, stay present with each other. So to that end, I'm going to invite each of you, please, to just soften or close your eyes. And if you don't feel like doing that, please just take your eyes off of me, maybe casting your eyes on your own body. And I have a tone going. There's sound in the room right now. I would like you to please, I invite you to give your mind an occupation and notice what you can hear. So there's some air coming into the room. There is the sound of my voice. There's whatever is going on outside of this room, folk walking by. And then there's this tone that I have going. If you could find the tone. And as you inhale through your nose and exhale through your mouth, please. And turn toward that practice for a moment, locating your breath, the sound of traffic, the sound of folk. There's a lot of sounds happening in this moment, at this moment. So notice them. We don't resist the sounds of the moment when we are doing any rituals. In my tradition, the sounds of the moment become a part of what you are doing because resistance takes energy. So rather, noticing the truck or whatever car that is sounds big. The sound of my voice, the tone, your breath, my breath. Inhaling through your nose and exhaling through your mouth. And as you are able, please decide that you will focus on the sound of my voice and the sound of Trina's voice. How appropriate. even with all the things going on, it feels like a metaphor for this moment. The world is busy, busy. The constancy of the news, the constancy of global horror and grief, the constancy of our responsibility to our children, to our grandchildren, to our partners, to our cousins, uncles, siblings. Like, we have responsibility to our vocation, our work, the day-to-day of the day-to-day. And all of the noise, the constancy of noise. And the practice is to focus and bring your awareness to one sound. The sound of my voice at this moment, the sound of Trina's voice, us in conversation, the inhaling and exhaling of it all. And guiding yourself again and again to this moment, this room. And the shared agreement is that we will listen to each other, that we will be as present as we are able to be with each other, that we will give the gift of attention. Softening your shoulders with that next exhale, noticing your feet planted on the ground, your hands perhaps holding something or just in your lap, or maybe holding your own body. And in my tradition, we honor the ancestors of the space that is holding our gathering, the ancestors of this land, the presence of memory in the soil, underneath the asphalt, underneath the concrete, the dirt that was here before, and I promise you will be here after. The roots that run so deeply underground that hold any moment. And then the presence of everyone in this room. The overlapping root system of being connected by blood or by agreement, by friendship, by witness, by decision. Inhaling and exhaling at your own pace, we welcome you to this moment as we open up the space between us. We are honored by the presence of those that you walk with. We are honored to be in each other's presence. And so, when you are ready, please, and not before, come into the room with your eyes open. Your breath even in your body. Prepare to listen. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Thank you for grounding us.
My pleasure.
So we're here to talk about this beautiful work, The Vibration of Grace, Sound Healing Rituals for Liberation, written and inspired by Gina Breed Love. And before we get started, I just want to say thank you. We have been in community for some years. We were trying to figure out how many. I can't remember because COVID years are a little disorienting.
Indeed.
But we've been in community and you've been a great support to me as an individual and helping me to remember and reclaim practices that I didn't know were actually a practice, such as humming and singing, and how that can be a healing method, medicine for myself to get reconnect to my body. But you've also supported Parenting for Liberation and being a sound healer for families as needed. When we had our Care for Caregivers some years ago, and we were talking when we started about how we had like a variety of different healers on the platform for folks to choose from, and you were one of them, and you didn't have as many spaces because of how busy or full your life may be. You said full, right? Which is a beautiful thing, but also knowing that the medicine and the information that you've been provided by Spirit, by Grace, is something that people desire to learn more about, That you took the time and energy to invest in putting it down on paper for us. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Because you can't be in all the rooms, and you can't do one-on-ones with all the families. And so now you've gifted us with this that we can pick up and begin to practice some of the medicine that you've been gifted. And so I want to jump into it. Are we ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. We're going to dive in.
Yeah.
My first question is around, you know, we're here to talk about grief, you know, as one of the elements of the book and one of the ways that sound healing can help move things out of our body. But there was a point in the text where you talk about trauma and grief and their distinctions. And so as we're going to be talking about grief, and I'm sure trauma will come up in our conversation today. I wanted to, you know, for you to tease out a little bit about the distinction, because I know sometimes I'm grieving things that are traumatic, or I'm grieving things from my childhood that might be considered childhood trauma. So how do we hold grief as not always traumatic?
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you. It's a beautiful point of entry. I think often the two get conflated, right? Particularly these days, there's such a broad brush around around wrapping things all together like some gumbo yaya, like everything is the same thing. And then these buzzwords that get thrown about, trauma is one of them. I think narcissism is another, and folk discover a thing and suddenly it becomes the thing and the answer to every challenge, and this person must be, and we start diagnosing ourselves and we start diagnosing each other. And grief is actually a normal response. Grieving is a normal response to loss. And because particularly in our country, which I can only speak to, from, you know, only having lived in the United States, grief and grieving is considered anathema, right? It's not sexy, so to speak. It makes you weak. It means you're weak. It means you're not able. It means there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with your mind. And it's been taken from us, like, for so many reasons, y'all. Like, as Black folk in this country, we understand the legacies of grief suppression. We understand why our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents might say, I'm gonna give you something to cry about, right? Or you better toughen up, or the world's gonna have its way with you. It's gonna eat you, it's gonna spit you out. That's been our experience here, right? So you're really thinking that you're trying to gift your child with some power, with some strength, with something to meet the systemic horror that it is living in the United States as a Black person. And it takes away our capacity to have all of our feelings, right? So if you're feeling some grief around some loss, right? Or you, this thing that you wanted, that you were praying for, that you didn't get. I mean, it might feel menial, it might feel simple, but your body wants to grieve about it, and you shut it down, right? Because you say, well, you know, I'm better off, or I'm too blessed to be stressed, or all of the ways in which we have been taught to swallow and to submerge a feeling. It doesn't go anywhere. It's energy. It just gets lodged in the body, right? It finds a place to hang out. It becomes the weight of the unsaid, or that energetic that makes you feel tired all the time. Unlet grief is an exhausting thing, right? So grief, which is, like I said, an organic response to loss, is not always about trauma. Right? No. It could just be about, I miss you, or, you know, I broke up with this person and I really love them, but we're not right for each other. Or I wanted that promotion and I didn't get it. Right? Or I'm missing my child. She's on the other side of the country. I'm going to grieve that. Mm. Right? That's grieving. It makes sense. Right? Or someone you love has died. I lost my mama in 2014. That was terrible, but it wasn't traumatic for me. You know, I'm not that loss cannot be trauma for folk, but making the distinction requires us to be in a practice of normalizing grieving, of grief. She had been sick for many years. It was terrible and it was a huge loss, but I wasn't traumatized by the loss. You know, I miss her every day. And sometimes I just lay out and let myself have that. But I wouldn't call it a traumatizing event, right? And I've experienced trauma in my life. I do know the difference, but it's difficult to discern the difference because we're just not allowing ourselves to have our feelings, right? And so when we are able to have them, it's all braided together and we cannot distinguish trauma from I'm sad, right? Because for all the reasons that I'm sure we'll do some exploring and get into, we're not allowed sadness, right? We're just not allowed sadness. We got to keep it moving. We got to put on our big girl panties, my least favorite, one of the euphemisms, the phrases that keep us not having and feeling and creating space. And y'all, I live in this realm. I'm here in this world. I'm a mama and a grandmama. I know that we have to keep our lives moving. I'm not suggesting that we don't. I'm suggesting that we create opportunity and time to feel the sadness.
Opportunity and time to feel the sadness. And I also hear you saying, like, I mean, you said so much, right? You gave so much grace for our history as a people. Because since our enslavement and that traumatic experience, there has been this like generational push to like make our kids strong, yes. Right? Put a lot of responsibility on them really early. We know about all the statistics around the adultification of Black children,
yes.
And what the impacts of that is. And when people outside of our community do it, how that creates more violence and harm,
yes.
For our children when, yes. They're adultified.
They're not allowed to be children. They're not children.
Right.
You know, yes, exactly.
Exactly, right?
We're saying.
Outside of us, outside of our community, that happens. And that leads to Black children being disciplined more, being pushed out of school more.
Mm-hmm. Sexualized.
Sexualized. Yeah. Little Black girls can't just be little Black girls.
That's right.
Black boys are seen as bigger, taller, more intimidating,
and
right?
And dangerous.
Yes. And so that's what the other people outside of us do. Mm-hmm. And then to be home, and then our family, our community, then tell our kids that they have to be tough. They have to be stronger, right? Like, how are we impacting our children's own, right? So I think about parenting. And a lot of times you said, like, in the text, you talked about how that was something passed down to you. Mm-hmm. And so many of us as parents sometimes are parenting from our own childhood trauma.
Absolutely.
Right? We're, like, trying to prevent a thing that happened to us. So we're doing a thing to our children.
Yeah.
And so what is the work that parents can do so that we can return and heal our own trauma from our childhood experiences to then not reenact it on the next generation? How can we utilize these rituals that you're sharing as a tool to interrupt intergenerational trauma? A big question.
Yes.
Big task.
It's a big task and it's a big journey and it takes time and practice. It takes ritual and rigor. And it takes generosity with yourself. The generosity that I know, I know that anybody in this room, if I was somewhere weeping, y'all come over and say, you all right? You know what I mean? Like, you would check on me. And we're so quick to do that. We always got a hand. I mean, it's just, it's part of our shaping, right? It's part of who we be as Black people. I've experienced it all my life, and I am that. And learning how to turn that hand toward my own body and place it somewhere that needs some care, right? That is a ritual, a practice. Please use the language that feels good in your mouth, right? I like the word ritual, so I'm gonna flip it out a lot, right? Because making my morning coffee the same way every day is a morning ritual, right? What do you do daily, you know? But making that a practice, that's another one of my favorite words, to give to myself the kind of spaciousness that I give so freely to other people, or to my daughter, or to my grandchildren, my partner, like turning it toward myself. And that takes time and some unlearning, because I certainly wasn't taught to do that,
no.
Right? I wasn't taught to do that. So the practice of it daily, like finding spaces in your day. I love to work with affirmation. So while I'm having my coffee, and I always notice my narratives around my worthiness, around my deservability, like the things that get planted generally before I start thinking my own thoughts or making my own way in the world, right? Before I did that. So I've been replacing for years. I've been in this practice for like 20 years, steady 25. I've been working with sound since I was 5 years old. I'm going to be 59. Like, I've been doing this work for a really, really long time. But I've been working with sound for soothing. Soothing grief, moving grief, soothing my body. But this thing about reprogramming or rewiring, shifting narratives around what I deserve, I work with daily, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm having my morning coffee and I'll say to myself, I am beloved, right? I am worthy. I am worthy of the love I give. You know, things like that, like to shift the things that still will rise in me around not being worthy. It's the stuff that I was fed in my cereal, right? And so this thing about how to use any ritual, any practice, first it's letting go of releasing any thought around immediacy, right? Releasing any thought around, like, we get sold all the time, do this 7 days and you will be, right? Or just like, you know, like, I think that practices, I know that for me, practice will be forever, right? Like, that I will be in a healing practice forever. And there are wins, right? And practice and ritual are the offering for embodiment, to feel embodied. So I would say taking your time.
Okay.
I work with sound because it's an immediate point of entry. And we do that anyway, like that song that we put on, especially, you know, that makes us feel better or more ourselves. It makes us feel like moving. That makes us able to weep. Like, we do it with music, you know. And we do it often unconsciously. So just like being intentional about it. I feel grief in my body. I'm gonna crank up this song so that I can move this grief. So I can lean into this whale. Because it's freeing, it's healing, it's enlightening. And we often won't allow ourselves to do it because of what we've been weaned upon, right?
Yeah.
So it's the undoing, Trina. It's the undoing, it's the practice, it's staying in it. It's the recording of it. It's noting the wins. It's not measuring what the wins are. I mean, even that language I know, but it's English. So it's the language that I have access to right now. But it's like, oh, I used to think this way about myself. It's been 2 weeks. I've been shifting this narrative. Oh, I feel better. I feel lighter. Or I feel like, oh, no, I deserve that love. Or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's committing to being inside of the practice and knowing that it looks different on different days. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because as we talked about in the beginning, life be lifing. So some days I can spend 30 minutes sitting sometimes, or meditating. Meditation, sitting and being quiet, or walking meditation. I know I tend to, my partner's always like, slow down. You say a lot in 5 minutes. And folks are like, oh, you know. So, and it's hard for me, that's how my brain works. So it's hard to focus on one path. But that also is, it's a multi-path practice, you know. And then you get to lean into the thing that really speaks to you. For some folk, it may be affirmations. It may be inside of the affirmation. For some folk, it may be working with the tones. There's guidance in the book for what we call your soul tones, finding the sound that makes you feel comfortable, right? It's probably that chorus that you keep on repeat, right? There's something in there. There's some tone or sound in there that drops your shoulders or makes you, you know, feel more yourself. I know I've said so much, but I think the basic beginning of a practice is to decide to practice, right? Mm-hmm. And to be with it. And some days it's 5 minutes, and some days you get an hour, and allowing yourself the grace and generosity that you give to other people.
That part.
Yeah, that part.
Because I know... Personally, I mean, I believe I can ask my friends, we could do a poll, but I feel like it's so much easier for me to give other people grace and love and compassion. Like you said, if someone was hungry or hurt or wounded,
That's right. You know,
we would all probably like run to support. But how often do I go all day without eating?
That's right.
How often do I go all day without being like, I made you tea. I was like, I forgot about myself, right? There's a way that we do that. And then when we become parents, we do that even more because we're supposed to sacrifice ourselves for our children. But I know that we can't pour from an empty cup. You can't pour from an empty well, right?
That's right.
And so I do appreciate you saying the generosity for ourselves. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah.
You know what it makes me think about? There's another part in your book where you talk about how we can be our own healer. Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning, like, we're taught we're taught really early on, whether it be through religion or other things, that our help comes from somewhere else. You know, look to the hills. Mm-hmm. That it's not about, like, and then if you say no, well, you can help. Because my favorite thing when people say, oh, you know, God can fix it and God can do it. And I'm like, I always quote that scripture, and my mom knows because she probably gets tired of hearing it. I say, faith without work is dead.
That's right.
So if you don't act on it, you can have faith that there is another being, entity, spirit, ancestors that can move and make provision for you. Mm-hmm. But simultaneously, what is the work that we can be doing to support ourselves? So do you want to talk a little bit about, like, how we all do have the capacity to heal ourselves?
Yes. And I love that faith without works is dead is one of my favorites as well. Because I, with so many of my my community, we were raised to look to to spirit, to God, to come and fix a thing, and we understand why that is and how that was shaped. And I actually believe in that energy. I believe in the energy of love. I think God is love. I believe in the energy of grace, of course. And I do understand that I have to make a choice, a decision, a reach, an ask, a turning toward, that it is my energetic that will put that in motion, right? Mm-hmm. That will make myself available to this energy of love and to this energy of grace that just can come through and flow through. There are things that are required of me. And that's where the without works is dead. Like, it's not going to come from me in my house generally. I'm going to have to leave my home, and I'm going to have to seek, and I'm going to have to ask the question and all the things. I know that we are weaned on so many lies around our capacity, around our brilliance, around our deservability, around how lovable we may be. And so this undoing of these narratives, this shifting of a narrative, is going to take some time, right? The opportunity, of course, is to, when we're nurturing our children, to fill them up with their own brilliance and love and accountability and all of the practices around rigor, right? And how we teach them. And we're shifting it for them, you know, we're shifting the generational line. So this being shaped to think that somebody else is going to come and save us, is another narrative that I am, I think, helping and guiding folk to shift themselves from, right? And that you do have the capacity to care for yourself. In the book, there are rituals around caretaking the needs of your own body, caretaking the needs of your spirit, going into these rooms, as I think of them, where hard or harmful things have happened, to retrieve yourself from that space, to be the witness of yourself, right? Your grown present moment self for the harm that you may have experienced as a child, right? And then learning the language of your body's response to a thing, because there are absolutely some spaces that I think we need help for, right?
Right.
So. That we need a guide for, and there are some spaces, okay. There are some
Please, thank
happenings
you.
That we can actually go back to, and that we can look at, and consider our young self experiencing a thing that we generally end up experiencing 10,000 more times through memory,
yes.
Right? A harm, a slight, when someone has abandonment, you know, being left somewhere, and then you get left 10,000, 30,000, 40,000 more times because you keep going back to the happening, and then that happening drives you and your behavior in the world. These are spaces that I know, because of witness and because I've done the work on my own body, and I've heard from folk who received the rituals and the practices and have done the work, you can go back and get yourself. And in that way, you are being your own healer, right? Mm-hmm. In that way, turning toward yourself in that moment of need. Like, I have this image of standing in the middle of the kitchen in my house with my arms raised and nobody picking me up. Right? Mm. Now, you know, we get taught that that's indulgent, right? To want to be picked up, you know, life is happening, I'm working three jobs, and I've, you know, like, we've been taught, we get you know, taught to be ashamed of the need to be picked up. I'm not vilifying our parents. I'm not vilifying our people. We understand where that comes from. But to shift and break that narrative, remembering that feeling and then turning toward myself and being the one in spirit and in my memory and in my imaginings that goes and picks up that baby girl and grabs her and holds her tight. Right? And that shifts and breaks the moment, you know? And in that way, I have just healed a moment for myself, and I am able to do that, right? And then I take it further. I will give her a treat or something she needs, or I'll ask her permission, you know, to bathe her, because the trauma that I experienced was childhood sexual trauma. And that's a particular walk, right? And then I tell her, but I got you, because I'm the adult in the room. So that three-year-old who's stuck in a moment doesn't get to decide, like, my partners, you know, I have folk that come to me, I keep dating the same person. Well, let's look at why, right? It's from this old place of need, you know? Yeah. And so there's some young part of me that's choosing my lovers and writing checks and, you know, it's, and so going back to reclaim and bring those parts of myself home means that grown-ass Gina in front of you is the one who will be making the decisions. And that's a practice. It's daily practice. And it's proportionate, really, I have found, to the kind of trauma that you may have experienced, or even sometimes the generational trauma, the trauma of our mothers, mm-hmm. you know, and what was in utero and what comes up in the body that is confusing to us, because you're thinking, I've never been. Why am I having this fear? And there is ritual around that as well. And it's all in the imaginal, and it's all anchored in the power of us. You know, the power of us. We've been told so many lies about our power and our capacity, you know, and when you start to turn toward it, you'd be like, well, hold on a minute. I actually could do this thing, you know,
and I've done that thing.
You know, so in that way, we are our own healers, you know, and I'm not saying that we don't, you know, somatic therapy is a beautiful thing. Healers are wonderful. Like, sometimes we do need another hand for the spaces that we cannot reach on our back. Right, this book is an offering from a healer and a holder. And so I ask folks, like, trust your body. If your body's like, absolutely not, I'm not going in that room, trust your body. Don't push past a no. But you know, like, if there's a part of you that says, oh, no, but I can sit with this one. I remember when this happened. Let me go get that so I can stop having this memory. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I do know. Because I'm like... People who in the room, they know I've been stuck in some memories. I'm going to quote something out of your book. Mm-hmm. You know, I got it already typed up. You said, what you're describing is the ritual of soul retrieval, mm-hmm. right? So you say, soul retrievals, rituals will often lead you to your younger selves.
That's right.
Which provides you an opportunity to heal the beginning places of you, to nurture and strengthen the root of you, and to replace narratives of self-loathing with mantras of worthiness, and you become your own healer.
Yeah, man.
You know, you said that.
Yeah, I did.
you wrote that. And I think that's so powerful, because when you were talking about earlier about like how childhood trauma and grief can get conflated, I was stuck in a story about my younger self around childhood sexual abuse. I was stuck in a story around my capacity to emote, right? Because I had lots of feelings as a child. People who know me would say I was what they call a crybaby. So I just had a lot of feelings. And sometimes they were not, it was too much for people to hold. And so you talk about, and I appreciate you talking about how you give grace to folks who may not even know in that moment that they're not holding the feelings that a person's feeling. And so you tell a story about your father in the book about how he didn't know how to encourage you to have feelings, like to cry, like that was not allowed in your household growing up, and that resonates. And so I guess I wanted you to share a little bit more about that and how from that experience of you not being able to cry or not being able to have access to your feelings, like how did you move to a place where now you literally hold grief circles and you hold space for people to like wail and cry. So how do you go from that childhood experience to then creating the capacity for not only yourself to cry, but holding circles for other people to also cry?
It's been years and years of practice, right? Yeah. I've been practicing for a lot of years. And my father, you know, I'm trying to see like a short version of a story, but my father had so much grief in his body. It was palpable, you know? Mm-hmm. And he couldn't grieve. He couldn't move it. And so even as a baby girl, I could see it. I think that that's also because it's part of my vocation. So I had sight. But you could certainly feel it. And I remember that I would make stories up about his capacity, because that's what, as children, we need somebody to be dry, right? We need somebody to be handling the situation. And so I would think, oh, you know, he's just wise, or he's sage-like, or he only speaks in monosyllables because he's got deep things on his mind, you know.
He's so deep, he can't.
Yeah, I can't understand. And it's what I needed, right? So much of what I understood and began to understand about him was after I got grown. But it's been, you know, I share in the book, Trina, that they wouldn't have called it a grief ritual, but my first grief ritual was with the mothers of my father's church, right? We grew up in Brooklyn. I am a crazy Brooklyn supremacist. I'm a big lover of New York. But my father took us to his place of birth, which is Apalachicola, Florida, a little tiny town. And he, because he needed help, my mom had left us. There were five of us. He just couldn't do it. And his sisters were all deaconesses in the church. There were five of them. So, you know, we had to go to church.
We was church.
Honey, I was wrapped in sheets and baptized in the river. Like, they were led through town. Like, I was like, okay, every day you were in church. And I loved it. I loved the ritual. Some of the doctrine was scary. I mean, the words, the language was scary because it didn't sound like love. You know, it was very, very homophobic. Right. And the patriarchy was thick. But the women, the deaconesses were fierce in the church, and they would gather weekly. And I think they would just call it women's night. And I'd be in the junior choir. I was 9 years old. But they would wail. They would have wailing sessions. It would begin with a hear it, and the women would be humming, and then it would become a wail, and it was like this song wailing, and then I would sneak in because I was that naughty Brooklyn kid and sit at the back, and I would watch the mothers lay hands on the younger women and lay hands on each other and tone and sing into the back of necks, into the back of hearts, holding the chest and singing and sounding, and the women would, I mean, it's not an elegant sight, y'all, but they would virtually be vomiting grief, right? Like mucus and and they would just be reaching in and pulling it out of the body with sound and with song and with holding and rocking. And I was fascinated because I had been humming into my own body for years, since I was really like five, you know? And so it felt familiar. I was like, oh, what is it, you know? And they would do it every week. And then, like, you know, I mean, what's time? I don't remember. I mean, it was choir practice was almost over. I know that. But the women would start to laugh and cough and, you know, noses blowing and like, oof, child. And, you know, what'd you bring? And like, you know, and they talk about the food and the feast that would happen after. And it was no thing. There was no stigma. There was no drama. There was no don't cry. There was none of that. It just happened every week. Right? We lived in Florida for a year and a half because they kicked us out of the town. That's another story. But they were like, they told my father, your kids are too wild. These little savages from New York, you need to leave. Right? My older sibs, they were pretty wild. But and I got to witness this every week. So it was normalized. It was not a big deal. I mean, it was, y'all know what I'm saying. Like, there was just, it's just something you did. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of discussion. It was just part of the fabric of the life. Mm-hmm. And I remembered that. Like, I kept that with me. I remembered that. The work that I do is absolutely my calling. So I have been guided through spirit. Often I'll go to bed and wake up with all of this information. It's part of where this book came from. It's where all of the rituals that I guide and teach folk come from. It comes from lineage, line. It comes from memory. It comes from the guidance of spirit. because I didn't know, like, the clarity of the information that I have never experienced, you know. I learned to trust it. I learned to allow. And I've been, like I said, I'm going to be 59. So I've been, you know, I've been on the walk for a long time, you know. Understanding and learning how to witness grief without taking it personally, right? Without taking it on that it's something I have to fix. In my work, like, there's something wrong with the person in front of me because they're expressing grief, but I couldn't do it until I started letting my own grief, right? Because what happens is I'm witnessing you grieving. It's stirring something in me, and I want you to stop, right? So, like, what can I give you? What food? What word? What psalm? What song? Can I just stem this, cut this off, stop this situation from happening? Right. You know, how fast can I tap you? Because of my own discomfort. So I had to be in rigor around my own expression. And that took time. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes some time. And it's where they work. And it's what I guide folk through who want to do grief doula work. Like, there are folk who are coming to me like, I want to do this work.
Yeah.
And it feels now like such a glorious expression of power to me when people grieve. Like, I have come all the way to the other side of what I feel about grief. It feels powerful, empowering. It feels like possibility. Like, you grieving is going to clear some space around your heart, mm-hmm. right? And plus, that thing you're grieving can become medicine for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, like the book, like Parenting for Liberation. Hi. The things we, you know, that we create for our community out of grieving, out of loss, out of seeing what is missing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, so it's like the systems of care and the things that we don't say we created it from grief, but we did. Some loss happened and it highlighted a space, a vacuum that we knew that we could fill and get other folk to fill from the brilliance of allowing, mm. right? Allowing that part of us to be open and exposed and to flow. Does that make sense? Right? Like,
I'm following you.
Trying to concretize and ground the language all the time. I'm always looking for ways.
But it resonates.
Yeah, it resonates. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I grew up in a church. It's actually a couple of church members in the room right now, as I see. Belmont Baptist Church represent.
Beautiful. I'm honored.
And I don't know if there was women's night, but I did. I was a churcher multiple nights a week.
Yeah.
And then all the youth things and Sunday school, vacation, Bible school, prayer meeting, Bible training, choir, everything, usher board, all the things.
Yes.
And I used to go, I don't know what they were called. They would have to tell me. I used to call them Wednesday night prayer circle or something like that. And there were times when it would be like no scriptures. It would just be humming and singing. And they would call it tarrying. You were tarrying for the Holy Spirit
That's
to pour
right.
down on you.
That's right.
And when you started bawling and weeping and snotting, it's like, oh, it got you.
That's
it came.
Right.
The Spirit has landed, you know?
That's
and
right.
So you get on your knees. They know what I'm talking about because they was in there probably
That's
yelling
right.
in the back of my neck. That,
That's
it's
right.
them. The elders are in the room laughing.
We need
I remember
to bring that back.
It should come
we
back.
We need to bring that back.
I'm like, I don't know if it still happens. I'm not.
Yeah.
Okay. They said it still does.
Brilliant. Beautiful. I want it to be, I want all folk to have an opportunity to
yeah.
sit at the table and be held from your own tradition, mm-hmm. right? What do you call it, right? Like, what do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's beautiful. I mean, I feel like that resonates. And I think that's why when you introduced me to this, to sound healing, or like gave it language, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's why I'm always just, if I talk to you and you say a word that is a word in a song, I'm just going to start singing to
the
you
song.
Out
yeah.
of nowhere. And it just seems like I'm just on another plane all the time. But music has definitely been a healing method. And when my dad passed away, I only could talk to people in lyrics. I only would be like, I don't even know what to say about my loss, but here's a song that I've been playing on repeat. And so I have playlists for people, and music has really been, music, sound, humming has really been a practice for me to move through.
Right.
So I do appreciate you putting it in writing. Another thing that you were talking about was how grief gets stuck in our body.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Black people, we experience everything times 11, right? We have the highest, you
That's
know,
right.
all the things, whether it be our children have more asthma than anyone else, or we have more heart disease than anyone else, or cancer, you know, all the things. Mm-hmm. And we also know about Black maternal health, and they talk about how Black birthing folks are more likely to die. You know, like, so it's in our bodies, it's impacting us being able to bring life forward. And there's this concept called weathering about how the stress of being Black in this country weathers on our body.
Yes.
So that although, you know, we say Black don't crack on the outside, mm-hmm. on the inside, that stress, that trauma, that grief is eating us from the inside out sometimes.
That's
right.
That's
and
right.
so
That's right.
a part of your work is about the healing medicine that we can give ourselves in order to heal from the inside out.
That's right.
I don't have a question, but I just want you to speak on that.
But you know, there's something coming up in my spirit.
Yeah, I figured.
That might make folk a little mad with me.
Oh, no.
But what I'm hearing is, what I'm hearing is that we also have to be ready to put the narratives down, right? The narratives become fused with identity.
Okay.
Right? Like, I am my pain.
Mm-mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And therefore I am, or I am every hit, right? Like mm-hmm. we've been weaned on that. Like, nah, that's all you got, right? Like this thing, this power, which is a power, but it comes from a place of, you're not gonna kill me, right? I'm not, you know what I mean? Like I remember, when I was a baby girl, like when I was being abused, like that energy of, I can't control what you're doing to my body, but you can't get my mind and my spirit, right?
Okay.
But there was a time, then I had to let that go because that was blocking, that energy was blocking my healing,
okay,
right? And so this thing of I am a strong, let's say Black woman, I am a strong Black woman. I can take it, you know, like I'm not gonna flinch, I'm not gonna move, I'm not gonna, or a strong Black man, like a strong Black body. So we don't get to be tender, or I don't get to have soft things against my skin, or I don't get to long for softness.
Mm.
I am soft. I am flesh. Like, it gets beat into us in all of these ways. And then it becomes a badge. It becomes armor. It becomes cloaking. It becomes protection.
That becomes heavy.
It's heavy. And we have to decide and that we're going to put it down, right? That we're going to we're going to begin, and that can happen through affirmation, it can happen through wailing practices, it can happen through ritual, but beginning to decide that that is not who we are, and we're going to end it, and it's not going to be in our children's cereal. Not to be confused with, we don't have to be strategists and strong and make good choices and clannish and, you know, and speak truth to power. Like, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the ways in which these identities get pressed into our skin, and we don't know where our skin and the identity begin and end. Right? And we get wed to it because we can get used to anything and we get comfortable in it because it's familiar.
Like that's just how it always is.
That's how it always is. It's how it's always going to be. And not only that, but it's what makes me in the world.
That we are our pain. Trauma and our
we
pain.
We are our trauma. We are our pain. I survived it. We've survived, you know, I mean, I'm trying to articulate what I hear a spirit saying in tongues, but it is making the decision every day that we deserve ease.
Amen.
That we deserve love. That we deserve rest. And it's a difficult place, right? We have to, it takes massaging, it takes work, it takes, if your practice is to pray, if your practice is to, you know, whatever, putting rose water in your, rose in your water every day to soften the heart. Like there are ways, right? There are points of entry to begin to move ourselves away from the narratives that have shackled us,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we have it for a reason. We have to be gentle and generous with ourselves there too, but we do have to make the decision.
To put it down.
Right. To where we're getting our power from, our sense of ourselves from, right? How much we can withstand, right? That's been forced on us in every way. And it's fake power. It's not sustainable. It kills us. You know, unlet grief will ossify around the liver, around the heart. It's energy, right? And it's heavy. Mm-hmm. And we can do it. We can do it through ritual. We can do it through ritual.
But like letting go of it.
We do it through ritual. We do it through, I mean, my book, there are other books that have been written about it. We do it through learning new ways to nourish ourselves. There's plant medicines. I mentioned rose. Rose tincture came up. There's flower essence. There's medicines. We do it through reading. We do it through shifting our mind. We do it through that psalm that we say on repeat. I play almost daily the 23rd Psalm by Bobby McFerrin. It's like from the Divine Feminine that he played for his mama, that he wrote for his mama, because the sound of his voice and then the language is medicine. The 23rd Psalm is medicine, right? And like listening to it low on repeat. Sometimes I'll sleep with it on really low, knowing that my consciousness is absorbing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like all the ways in which we can undo a narrative and making the decision to get our power from the softest parts of us, maybe. From our capacity and ability to love, not to withstand, you know, because that's been forced on us.
And it's not ours anymore.
And it's not ours. And it's also, you know, Black people will save it, do it, and we keep doing it. We're saving it for our children, saving it for ourselves, right? Saving it because we want, saving it, the world, democracy, what is it? Because we want our babies to be safe.
Yeah.
Right? And doing it from a place of also, and we deserve softness.
Yes.
And kindness and generosity and ease.
We do.
Yeah.
We all deserve that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if people will be mad at you about that one.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah. That's my own old narrative.
Yeah. No, that resonates in terms of like us always in this. It makes me think about a quote that has grounded the work that I do at Parenting for Liberation, which is by Audre Lorde, which is about raising Black children in the mouth of a racist, sexist, suicidal dragon is perilous and chancy.
That's right.
If they cannot love and resist, they probably will not survive, right? And that's so right. I think what you're bringing up is that we do have the fight, and we have to be strong, and we have to resist, and we have, you know, like, we have to be resilient as Black people. But we also, she says, love and resist. Mm-hmm. Love came first. Yeah, and we focus so much on fighting and, you know, that strong Black woman narrative. But before that, we have to also, the capacity to love. And so I do think that is about the both and of, we can't only be fighting if we're not also creating capacity, building our capacity to love, building our children's capacity to love.
Yes. And taking their sense of themselves by how deeply they are able to love, right? Getting their sense of themselves by how powerful love is, you know, and shifting the narrative around it, the weakness. We're not talking about a weak love. You know what I mean? What are we talking about? Empress Toni Morrison say thick love? We're talking about thick love. We're talking about a power. Love as a power. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And shifting the narrative around how that would make us weak.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Know? To love.
You know, okay, I have one more question, then I'll open it for folks. Thinking about our children, right? Thinking about we do this work because we care about, you know, the future generations. Mm-hmm. You talk about how you received your gift in humming at an early age.
Yes.
Some folks may say like, oh, it's too young to talk to our kids about rituals and grief and all of that. I'm curious, like, of the rituals that you have in the book or the medicine that you provide, like, how do we integrate and bring our children into the practice so that they have a practice early as medicine for themselves? Like, what are some recommendations you have for that?
I have a 3.5-year-old grandson.
Look at that smile.
Yeah. I have two grandsons. One is 1 year old and 1 is 3.5. And the 3.5-year-old and I are really thick. And
thick love.
Thick love. And he's been on my hip while I've done ritual since he was able to sit on my hip. And so in my tradition, my rituals look like I will make offerings to the river, right? from African spirituality traditions. I bow to many altars, you know. My tradition of origin was Baptist with a little bit of holy roller praise thrown in. And also, you know, the minister talking about missionaries and telling me when I was 9 years old that I would be a missionary, right? Like, so all that shaping. But I've also studied some African spirituality, and the things that appeal to me are offerings to the natural world. And I've been taking that baby boy to the river to make offerings to Oshun. Since he was small, we have an ancestral altar. He will put offerings on the altar. You know, we offer coffee to our ancestors. He will place a small cup of coffee. I'll come upstairs. There are coins on the pictures. Like, he has done that himself. Like, there's a reverence that for our ancestors and for ritual that was instilled in him just because he was with me. You know, I didn't highlight it and I didn't make it it's like taking the babies to church, right? It's like taking him with me. And the way that I speak to him, and the way I hold space with his grieving, the way I give him the opportunity to grieve, but also talk to him about his capacity to decide and figure it out and to find his way through this thing, whatever it is that he's holding or upset about, always reaffirming his power. Teaching him about discipline, because I know that our babies, particularly our Black boys, but our Black children, like, they need to, we know that to have a language around discipline for themselves, to care for themselves in the world, but also discernment, trusting yourself. You know, if the energetic you feel is telling you don't go over there, or that person is not a person you want to hold space with, trust yourself, believe yourself. It's repetition, like all teachings, right? Mm-hmm. But I find that they're giving him the grace of my witness when he's sad about something, mm-hmm. you know, and not trying to usher or push him past it or through it, you know, and now that he's cresting into four, you know, no, you're not going to lay on the floor and start banging and acting bananas. You are going to use your words. You know how to do that. You're going to gather yourself. You're going to sit for a minute and consider. You know, you can cry, but we're not going to do that. Muzo, you know you're not supposed to, but that's not how we solve. You know what I mean? It's age appropriate, mm-hmm. right? He's going to mm-hmm. be 4 years old. That's not how we're going to do that. We're not doing that in a grocery. We're not doing that. So, but we are going to take a moment and a pause and a breath. And so we teach him breath work. We teach him to lay hands and place hands on his own body. We teach him to locate himself, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And just meeting him where he is at each point. To reinforce that you have capacity, you know, and also reinforce that you can ask for help, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's part of it. Mm-hmm. And witness, it's a powerful, powerful gift.
To be seen
mm-hmm. and allowing, and teaching him accountability now.
Yeah, that's important too.
Yeah, now. As much as he'll understand. So, yes.
Beautiful. Okay. Thank you for chatting with me. Curious if folks in the space have questions. Anyone? Anything bubbling up for people?
How do you allow love? Give love.
Yes.
But you won't allow it.
I practice it. That's a multi-pronged approach for me. It has been because I didn't trust anybody. And giving is powerful. It felt powerful, and it felt like I could dictate the relationship. Mm. Right? If I'm the one, then I have the say. Right? This is my house. Right? That kind of thing. Practicing and holding myself around the reasons why I didn't trust. And being in those rituals, as I shared about getting myself out, retrieving myself, those soul retrieval rituals, which are ancient rituals, right? That can show up in all of our traditions, I have found through my research. There's in my church, it would be calling yourself home, right? That was the language. Go get yourself. Right? It's that. Returning to these sites of harm, these trauma sites, and getting myself back And having these conversations, like active conversations with this baby girl who's like, I don't trust, nobody's safe, nobody's, this is, you know, and assuring her in myriad ways that you are safe. I got you. And you deserve love and you deserve gentle touch. I know that that touch was horrible, but you deserve gentle touch. And I trust you, and I trust, you know, like, it's a language, it's a dialogue, and it's practice. I did date the same person over and over again for years, who would just, it was attrition and throwing me under the bus every chance they got, and, you know, not having my back and all of those things. And so it took some time and it took practice, and it got to the point where I could just, oh, I see you coming. I recognize you. I know this one. You know, I know what this is. And then beginning to practice giving love to myself. Like, I'm going to take that bath. I'm going to buy those flowers for myself. Mm-hmm. Like, it can sound kind of trite, but it's not. No. I'm going to spend an extra $50 to fly up in this class for my body or whatever. And I'm going to eat well, like starting to love on myself. So that when someone started to bring me love, or I chose better, and wanted to give me love, that I knew it when I saw it because of how it felt in my body, you know? Because I certainly knew what the other felt like. So it was a retraining. And I still stay in practice. Like, sometimes I'll go weeks and weeks and I'll be feeling like, oh, I feel so loved, I feel so good. And something will happen that will send me right back to harm. You know, I'll hear something, I'll smell something, like sense memory, you know? And then I don't trust anybody again. Now I'm in so much practice that I know that it's happening, but I have also chosen someone that's been like, are you okay? Like, what happened? You know, that will give me the space to let me consider, oh no, that's not about you. Actually, I was having a memory, right? That's not you. That's not this time. That was 30 years ago, like that kind of thing. So you have to stay in practice. But I started by giving myself things. Yeah, why not? Why not lay on some rose petals? I'm by myself in this bed. Why not? Right? Why not feel, you know, those things? Like, why not? I like that smell. I'm going to get that for myself. Nobody's smelling me but me. Oh, yeah. You know, that thing. Yeah, yeah. Practice.
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Other folks?
Yes.
I heard you talk a lot about, you know, the ritual and practice. And for me, I have my rituals and my practices, but I'm not consistent. And I know that within that practice and those rituals that I have, it brings me so much joy, so much love, so much like grounding in my spirit and in my body. But I feel like I'm punishing myself by not being consistent. And I was like wondering, how did you over the time, like, build in that consistency, that practice, that taking care of yourself that I think I've struggled with sometimes?
That's such a fantastic question. Thank you for the question. Because, I mean, I was today years old, right? Before I started, like, I'm sometimes like breaking a promise to myself. Mm. And I'm a master practitioner. I'm like, why are you breaking? What's going on? And this is recent, like in the last couple of months. That's why it's up for me. I was like, where have I not done this soul retrieval? Who is this young person that doesn't feel she deserves? Like, this is the whole practice around soul retrieval. So I had gone back to get 5-year-old Gina from the doorstep where she watched her mama leave. And 11-year-old Gina, where her father was making heinous decisions. Like, I had gone back and done that work. But there was a Gina, there was an aspect of myself that felt like, I just want to whoop it up, basically. That's freedom. Like, I don't want to have rigor. I don't want to have responsibility. I don't want to take care in that way. And I discovered, like, oh, I discovered what part of my life where I was feeling that and doing that. And it was almost defiant. There was a defiance. I don't have to do that. That was like my 13, 14-year-old self, right? And so when I'm working with folk, when I'm working with clients, when I'm working with folk I'm graced to work with, and they ask the same question, I'm like, just think for a moment, like, what part of your life, right, where you would feel so defiant about these rituals, where you just want to shrug it off or throw it off? And for me, it was connected to, ain't nobody watching anyway. Nobody's caring for me. Like it was like a real teenage response to not being cared for, right? Mm-hmm. So even grown Gina, with my grown hands, wanted to do this work, there was still this active part of me that would just throw it off, shrug it off. Mm. Soul retrieval helped me to quell that and helps me to. Real defiant, real like, I mean, forgive the language, but fuck everybody, fuck everything. This don't work. It don't matter. That's not how I feel on any given day. That's an aspect of me and a part of me. And so I would just go back and work with that part of myself, you know, and be like, I know that this comes from grief. I know you feel neglected and not loved. I'm going to take care of you. I got you. Right. And so getting myself and working with that part of me to the point where if I'm about to break a promise to myself, it's so glaring and loud now and clear that my grown self steps in. I'm like, no, I have decided that this is the ritual that I'm going to, like, for me, often it's I'm not going to drink alcohol while I'm working because my work is in spirit and it's intense. And, you know, and there was a younger part that was like, I can do what I want. You know, eat what I want, go where I want, that kind of thing. And so not breaking that promise to myself, staying inside of the life that I want for myself. And it requires discipline, you know, but I hope that's helpful. Like really leaning into, like if you check out the chapter on soul retrieval, right? The parts of us that step forward, like, you know, the memory that you have, is usually the part where that you need to lean in and go in and hold space with that aspect of yourself. Right? And go get yourself. Go and get yourself and bring yourself to the table. Because I will say too about soul retrieval and sexual trauma or any kind of trauma around identity or horror or us not being allowed to be. The 5-year-old Gina that I got back from being abandoned by my mama is so much more than abandoned, right? She's also really funny. You know, and believes that the moon is watching her. Like, it believes in God unequivocally, right? Jesus is a friend of mine, my 5-year-old self. Like, I need her. She's more than just a baby girl who was abandoned. So once I get her off the doorstep, because it was a literal doorstep while I watched my mama drop away, I get access to all this other juiciness that this baby's working with. Like the baby girl who was sexually abused. She's so much more than abused. You know, she's also smart and fierce and defiant and fire. Right? I need her. Yeah. So I have to take her out of that moment, take care of her so that I can also have access to all of this other brilliance that we are, that we walk with, that trauma doesn't kill, mm-hmm. but it does quell. But it doesn't kill it. It's still there,
yeah.
You know? And I also want to say, too, because I've been talking a lot about abandonment, that my mama and I, like, I was graced to make up with her. Like, you know, I miss her every day. And she did make that choice. And we did come back together. And that feels, like, important for these days. I'm doing a lot of talk about it. So, like, for balance, just for my spirit. Mm-hmm. As she trips the light fantastic somewhere with the ancestors. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, fam? Yes, ma'am.
How do you release a hurt that you have? No intention of speaking out.
Yes.
Loud, or you don't want to discuss with anyone.
Mm-hmm. That I have done in the book I write about incest. I never talked about it. That's my dad. I want to protect him. You know, the multiple truths of loving someone who's harming you. You know, mm-hmm. And but I knew to have a full life where I had access to my body, because like, how am I going to own my body if every time I want to touch someone, you are who I see? This is what I remember. Mm. I own my body. I want to own my body. And so I have to go in that room but determined not to talk to anybody about it. Not just because of shame, but because of protecting.
Protection.
I want to protect him, you know, because he's my dad. So that's a gorgeous question. What I did was the soul retrieval rituals. Like I would go back and get myself out of that harm. I would go back, like, and I allowed myself to be pissed. I allowed myself to be really angry. And not get caught in the why and how he may have been abused or his story, because the baby girl does not care about that. Grown Gina might care. But the one who's being abused, I'm not going to fill her his story. How am I going to rescue her and say he did the best he could? Yo, we get caught in the they did the best they could. We do. It does. It's true. They did. But it's not about our people. And I'm not vilifying our people. I'm not. Horrific conditions that our folk have come through still. You know, we know that. So it's not about that. It's about the impact on the young one. And we have to give our young ones, or all parts of us, the opportunity to grieve a thing, even if the person who did the harm did the best they could. We have to, we must. My mother did the best she could, and she left 5 babies. I was 5 years old. I was in constant danger. You know what I mean? Like, she did the best she could, but if I stayed in her story, I would never get those babies. I would never bring them home. And so with my dad, doing that work with that baby girl, and not forgiving him, forgiveness is a practice. I believe in it and it's gorgeous, but I don't believe in premature forgiveness. And I couldn't forgive him until I had brought her home. And that took time. And there are rituals in the book about how to move anger, because anger is real, right? It's real. And we swallow it. It gets caught in the throat. It blocks the word. It blocks our glory. And so I would get mad. And I did this ritual where I put some old plates in a sheet and not the pillowcase, and bang and bang and bang, and cry and bang out that anger. Because it needed to leave my body. There are many rituals to move anger, y'all. That's just one. And then once I got her home and I did the ritual and I took care of myself and I grieved, you know, I was able to begin a new relationship with him. I was able also to let him be more than an abuser, right? And so that happens with harm, and a harm that you will never speak about, but you can still go get yourself. You can still get yourself from it, and take yourself out of someone else's egregious and fucked up behavior. So I own my body now. I own my body. Y'all, can I tell you? And I've done that work with women who have been abused, because it's such a flagrant, horrific problem, sexual trauma in our country and in the world. And you gotta stay in practice, but you get your body back. You get to own your body. So I hope that was helpful. You know, I hope that was helpful. And then telling the story, because I know I'm not the only one. And if it could be of service to other people, then I must do that, because that's my vocation, right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't have a question, but just an offering for an acknowledgement for myself that, as you said, you know, our parents have their own generational trauma, and sometimes they're passing it on to us. And so for me, if something's going on with me and I'm not aware of how it's coming out, there'll be times where my son will say, "Don't take out your frustrations on me. Like, because you're mad at so-and-so, don't take it out on me." And that just, like, wakes me up, because he's right. Usually I'm upset about some other thing, and then I end up, like, screaming at him, but it's not about him. Yeah. So the fact that he's able to, like, recognize that, I feel pretty proud.
Good work, Mama. Because,
you know, the stuff I feel that I've gotten from my mother and not really able to understand it, like, figuring out for myself, and then going back and checking in with her, and then she's like, "Yeah, I had some abuse," or "Yeah, I've had this or that," and, like, okay, it makes sense to me now. Yeah. So I feel like I'm really interrupting those patterns as a mom, and so the silent thing works, but so much, and then at some point you have to, like, come face to face with it and, like, talk about it, you know. So no one wants to talk about abuse, right? But you know that you want a fuller life, a richer life. You don't want to pass down those traits to your children or your grandchildren. So that's how I think about it.
It's
Thank you for that. And it's, you know, and it's so wonderful that you get to talk to your mom still in this realm in real time and connect the dots. That's awesome. I'm happy for you. Yeah. And yeah, you know, we are, and you gave him this language. You gave him the language. I mean, good. That's wonderful. We are absolutely shifting and changing and expanding and healing. We are doing it. I see it happening.
Amen.
I saw that here, some little boys on the schoolyard talking, 11 years old? I'm having big feelings. Little black boys, I'm having big feelings about this. I'm like, okay, that's what we're talking about. And I need a minute. All right, come on, get your minute.
That's what you need then.
Yeah, take your minute, little black boy. Take your minute, take five. Come on there. I think it's wonderful the way our babies are talking to each other. I see it happening.
You see the shift.
I see the shift. It's us. And we still breathing. We still here, taking up space in this realm. We do get to be free. And what is freedom, right? True freedom. Y'all, I know that's a much more complex conversation because I know where we live and I know what time it is on the clock of the world. At least, you know, from what I see. But I can feel free in this body. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Any other folks? One more burning question.
Could you speak on accessing the power of apology?
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that question. Yes. I am. Apology is also a practice because we got 1,000 ways to kind of apologize. I'm so sorry you feel that way. Just one of them. And all of them, right? It takes time because for me, the shame associated with something that I may have done something wrong or hurt somebody or be less than in the person's eyes or like so many different reasons. So apology, I started thinking about the power of apology really and beginning a practice with it when I told my mother that she was the first person to break my heart. And I was scared to do it. And I was like, oh, she's just gonna make it about herself. And this was about 15 years ago. And I did, I called her up one day, urged by spirit. And cause it was like, you're not gonna tell it for her, you're telling her for you. Mm-hmm. And I did, and she listened and she said, I'm sorry. I mean, really, for my mom, that was amazing because my mom had a lot of arrested development around relationships and apology and what her mother had left her. And she did. She listened and she witnessed, and it began a new opportunity for us to be in conversation. And I spent some time in Rwanda in 2018, and I saw what rigor, practice, ritual, supported the healing between the Tutsi and the Hutu tribe. Of course, I'm speaking of the Rwandan genocide that happened in 1994, and how the Hutu people murdered hundreds of thousands of Tutsi folk. And I had the opportunity because of hate speech, because of colonialism, because so many reasons, y'all, we can, you know, draw the line straight to the feet of the French, the Dutch, America. I mean, there's so many fucking reasons for what happened in Rwanda. And please forgive me, I digress as usual. What I want to speak to is how the folk of Rwanda decided, the Hutu and the Tutsi people decided that it would never happen again. Two, that they would heal and that they would share what was happening and what had happened with the world. So in prayer and hope that it would not happen elsewhere. This reconciliation that happened because the folk who had committed the atrocities would come to the family of the people they had harmed. Sometimes people they were directly connected to by the violence, and they would apologize and ask how to make amends. And I work with two such folk, a man and a woman. And the man had hit the young woman when she was 13 with a machete and chopped up, you can see the marks in her skull, and left her for dead. And she survived by pretending to be dead. And and, you know, hearing their story in circle in this community of folk who were dedicated to the healing of Rwandan people and how they came together and she forgave him and he forgave himself. And it took time, and he apologized and did what he needed to do to make amends. And she wouldn't talk to him at first, but she said, you know, Spirit, God told her to give him an opportunity. And they spent years rebuilding and building because they wanted to. Like, they wanted to heal, and he said, and he wanted his children to not be at the effect of this kind of hatred and horror. And that if he did not apologize and move it out of his spirit and move love in its place, that they would be infected by the hatred. That this was the language that they used in these reconciliation, truth and reconciliation convenings, where they actually did the work in Rwanda. An apology was at the root of it. It was extraordinary. It blew my mind, and it made me understand what is possible here, you know, in our country, where we need to do so much incredible healing. So it's a power indeed, right? It's a power indeed. You can set things free, release, you know, oh, so many opportunities in apology. And when I'm able to do it well and I'm able to do it in a righteous way, I can see the alchemy of it, especially on my daughter, you know? Yeah, I can see it in her body, like her shoulders. And it's like flowers bursting on her face. Like, when I can apologize and witness and affirm her, it's an incredible medicine.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay, I had said that was the last one.
Yeah.
So that was the last one.
Okay.
Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
I know that do we do book signing now, or you want to do the ritual now?
I think we should close and then do any book signing that anyone wishes. And I'm going to close, please, with some sound.
Beautiful.
And I'm going to ask everyone again to soften and close their eyes. And please just find yourself to the most comfortable position that you are able in this moment, in this space. And inhaling and exhaling, so much has been shared in this room today. And even if you may not feel it in this moment, this work, this talk, this unearthing of things, of lineage, of line, of origin story, can bring up a lot of grief in the body. And often it will make us afraid. We have these narratives of, if I start crying, I will never stop. Fam, I promise you that's not so. In the 25 years I have been doing grief work with folk, you may get laid out. That's appropriate, but you will be able to gather yourself, I promise. And you will not die. We're not releasing grief, sourcing grief, and moving grief will surely kill us. So inhaling and exhaling at your own pace, please. And knowing that you may move some grief later on today. In a few days, you're doing something that you always do, like washing dishes or washing your body, and you'll feel a wave of grief come over you. I encourage you, please, to soften your shoulders, turn toward it like a wave coming at you. And, you know, I was taught as a baby girl on the beaches in Apalachicola that when a wave comes at you, you dive toward it, you go under and let it roll over your body. And then you come up for air. And I feel that way about grief, allowing it to move through the body, to not question it, to not check it, to not tell yourself how blessed you are. The two can live in the same place. You can be blessed and still grieve. And allowing your body to move the weight of it, and touching your own face the way you would touch the face of a child, or your own skin, or holding your own body, because you deserve it. And that is how we caretake and move grief, through practice. And so inhaling and exhaling at your own pace, please, inhaling through your nose and exhaling through your mouth. Please feel the weight of your feet on the floor. Feel your body in the chair, you know, where the bottom of you is meeting the chair, and allowing the chair to support you. If you can lean back, please lean back and let the chair hold the weight of your body.
As you inhale and exhale and soften, then drop those shoulders. Right? And we already were honoring of the ancestors of this land, knowing that there is earth beneath this concrete and asphalt, its dwelling, and the earth is enduring and has memory. And deep, deep, deep into the soil, you will find overlapping roots, a one root system of trees holding this moment. Always, whether we are aware of it or not, sitting, standing, moving upon the earth that is holding us. Allow it at this moment as you inhale and exhale. Notice the back of your skull, the back of your neck. Please take a journey down your spine, bone by bone by bone, vertebrae by vertebrae, and all the spaces in between. Pause for a moment and turn to your left and notice your beating heart. As you inhale through your nose and exhale through your mouth, there's not a person in this room who does not have a warrior heart. A heart that beats through despair, that beats through grief, that beats through terror, that beats through love and joy and newness and dancing and that first bite or that first sip of something wonderful prepared for you, a heart that keeps going and greets you every morning with, I'm here, 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 I'm here. And then to your left, that liver, the dark richness of your liver and the organs in between and the long and the short of the intestines and your pelvic floor. Keep journeying down the back body. There are your kidneys on either side of your spine. The tip of your spine, the backs of your thighs, your knees, your calves, the soles of your feet. Breathe and notice the depth and weight and width of your body, the space you occupy. And as you inhale through your nose and exhale through your mouth, family, please consider and recall your name. The name you call yourself or the name you've been given, how it feels when someone says your name or calls you what they call you with love in their voice and recognition, how it feels. As you consider that and listen to that, please listen to these tones that I offer up to move through the thousands of pores that cover your skin, to join the blood and to circle your heart in love and possibility. Inhaling and exhaling at your own pace, allowing the sound to rest on your shoulders, considering what it feels like for a soft, warm rain to just cover your skin. And feel your breath and know that each inhale is a gift and each exhale is relief. And being held in the notion of your name. We are closing the space we have opened between us. Those who walk with you will walk with you, and those who walk with me will walk with me. Until such time, and not until we decide to open the space between us again, and when we do, we will be more ourselves on this journey of reclamation, of going to get yourself and bring yourself home to the table of you, because we need all of ourselves for this walk. I release this word into the inexhaustible alchemy of love. And I seal it for all times as I affirm. Ashe, aho, and amen. And however you close and affirm a thing from your tradition, please do so now in your spirit or audibly as you choose.
Amen.
And so it is. Ashe.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Parenting for Liberation. I hope something on this episode will inspire you on your parenting journey. Please like us on all social media at Parenting for Liberation. Until next time, let's get free, y'all.